Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 532. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm back with another good discussion lined up. We have with us Jim Cassidy, who serves as the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's good to be here, man. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's just you and me today with a good subject, but I'm digging through some topics and things that we've been hoping to talk about for some time, and one of those is another subject matter from the Westminster Theological Journal, Fall 2017 edition. That's Volume 79, Number 2. Jim, to the listener here, has written a review article, which is a review of Karl Barth and the Incarnation by Darren O. Sumner. If I'm looking here at the bibliographic information, you can find this published by Bloomsbury, T.N.T. Clark, back from London, published in 2014. It's only $92.12, list price cloth. So.
Yeah, it's a steal. Seriously, it's a fantastic book. And it's worth every penny, but it when you look at these books that come through and you figure it's made up of mostly paper or paper products, the fact that they charge $92 is like, whoa, right?
Yeah, but it's economics. You're looking at the number of people that might be buying it. You're trying to recover the cost of production. And, you know, it's hard for people to understand sometimes. It was for me. It's becoming easier to understand now that we've published our own book. But you receive a book, you buy a book, your brain tends to think that you are purchasing this physical object, which you are. But then there's a quick jump for your brain to assume and to think, well, since you received this physical object, then the cost of this physical object is really what's built in, is the majority of this price, that is not true at all. And so that's why you'll find, you know, you might buy an $11.99 paperback and, you know, the ebook's, you know, $8.99 or something. It seems out of whack. Because when you're just reproducing a digital file, the marginal cost there is zero. So, you know, in traditional economics, you know, in a perfectly competitive environment, which never exists, then marginal revenue approaches marginal cost. And basically all that means is if it costs zero to reproduce something and to distribute it, then the cost and the price will eventually approach zero. But that's not really feasible for an author or for a publishing house. And the majority of the cost of a book is in all the time that went into it. And I would assume that Mr. Sumner spent so many hours on this that even no matter how much of a royalty or advance he received, it's probably less than minimum wage.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption. And, you know, I had the kind of strange experience of being able to publish my dissertation, and Amazon sells it for under $20. Now that may be a reflection of the inferior quality of the material that is contained therein, or what, I don't know. But Sumner's book is definitely superior in every way to my own, and it deserves the higher price. But I have a feeling a lot of it has to do also with the particular publisher, and maybe even has something to do with where that particular
market.
Publisher is based out of, you know, UK as opposed to United States.
Well, there's
it's an academic press and all
TNT
that other
Clark's
stuff.
The big time. Like that's a big publisher. They do a lot of Barthian scholarship, but TNT Clark has also done quite a bit on the liberal and progressive side. I know a lot of the Ronarian scholarship that I've read has often been published by TNT Clark or subsidiaries therein. And so it is a different market. It's getting in different fields. So we love what Lexham's doing. Jim's book is published with Lexham through Logos digitally, but also the Lexham Press and the hard copy you can buy. So it's still a high quality book and a great publisher. But the way TNT Clark rolls, it's like Brill or Oxford University Press and, you know, these other publishers that are often targeting the scholar, the hyper specific scholar, or, you know, an academic library, and then the price follows because they're expecting only to sell several hundred or maybe a few thousand.
And they know that the libraries that have to have the book have to have it. And so, you know, they got to pay the price. So it's kind of a supply and demand. Extortion.
No. Extortion. That's
no,
way
it,
to put
it's anything but that, of course. And we're thankful, aren't we, for having publishers that are willing to put out quality scholarship out there still today, in today's day and age, with such an electronic age and entertainment age, that's still good quality scholarship writing and material is being available to be placed in our hands still for reading and research and all of that. So something we're very thankful for.
Absolutely. Well, why don't you explain to our listeners the difference between a review article and a book review, at least in as is concerned the Westminster Theological Journal? Because you won't always see review articles, but once in a while you'll find one. But they're at the back are always quite numerous book reviews.
You're absolutely right. This is, if I could, Camden, just want to say a word about the Westminster Theological Journal. This may be sound more like a plug than really it's intended or thought to be. I want to encourage our listeners to go ahead and subscribe if you're able to, if you have the budget for it, whatnot, to subscribe to the Westminster Journal. I know, Camden, you're a longtime subscriber.
Oh, yeah.
I've been a longtime subscriber since I graduated from seminary, and in the pastoral ministry the last 15 plus years that I've been in the ministry, I've gotten the journal without any interruption in my subscription over those years, and I have found it to be extremely beneficial. There was a time, Camden, when I had the time, I think, to sit down and open up the Westminster Journal and actually read it from cover to cover. Doesn't seem to be the case anymore. I don't know if you have the same experience.
I've never had that experience, but that's amazing. I see you sometimes post on Instagram or Facebook where you're sitting there with the journal and you have a nice cigar.
Cigar in one hand, the journal in the other.
I guess if you had pretty big Churchill or something, you could get through a good chunk of that journal, but wow.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. Yeah, and it is great. I try to read as many of the articles as I can, and I usually prioritize with the ones that have special, you know, interest to my field of study, which is systematic theology and Karl Barth particularly, and modern theology more generally. But and then as I have time, I hit the other ones. But you were mentioning the reviews, so and what the difference is between regular review and a review article. At the end of the journal, you always have a number of books that are being reviewed, and I love to read those, even if I don't read them word for word, at least to skim through those, because they are very short. Usually it's a synopsis of the book and then an evaluation of some sort by the reviewer. And those are usually what, one page and a half.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah. It's tiny font, but, it is, yeah, they're about a page, maybe two tops.
Yeah, they're not very long, but the benefit to it is that it keeps you kind of informed and engaged as to what are the current trends, the scholarship, what books are coming out, and what people are talking about and such. So it has, for the pastor who is much too busy to read all those books, the reviews, the book reviews are very, very helpful and will help you to discern whether or not that book is worth actually purchasing. So you read the review and you go, well, yeah, that was a good review. The content sounds like something I'm interested in exploring further. I'll go ahead and pick it up, or not. And then you don't go ahead and kind of risk spending the money buying a book, receiving it, reading it about 15, 20 pages in and realize, shouldn't have bought this. Not really what I was looking for. So reviews are very, very helpful. I encourage our listeners to subscribe to the Westminster Journal and check out the book reviews, because those could be very useful. Also, now the difference though between those and then what I did. So just the quick story, the backstory, Camden, to all this is that I had gotten a copy of Darren's book, and it was with a view towards writing just one of those regular book reviews at the end of the journal. And as I began to read the book, I was overwhelmed with just how excellent it was, and how more than anything else, the issues that Darren was bringing to the surface needed to be engaged with at greater length than what one of those short book reviews enables you to do. So I went back and I asked the book review editor if I could turn it into a review article, and he had mentioned, well, yeah, that really falls outside of my jurisdiction. I'm going to have to send you over to the articles editor. And that articles editor went ahead and approved turning this into a review article for the articles section. And anyway, I'm glad that they were amenable to me doing that and going in that direction with this, because I really wanted to engage in a close and careful way with this book. It's the type of book that I think warrants that type of lengthy engagement. And so that's what we have here. It's a review article. It's more like the length of a regular article that you'll find in the Westminster Journal, as opposed to one of the shorter book reviews at the end.
I thought you were just going to say you started writing the book review and just wrote too much.
Well, actually, that is what happened, and I didn't. And I went back.
You couldn't edit yourself, and so you just turned it into a review
article. And I just, I have enough arrogance and big enough of an ego to think that I couldn't actually cut anything, and that everything I said was important.
I like reading,
but it's not me. It really isn't. It's not that I had anything important to say, but it's just the issues that are raised really are worth engaging in at greater length.
And you won't find in a book review too much critical engagement. You can say a few things. You can ask a few questions. You could say, I wish I would have, you know, the author would have said this or developed this. But it's not the place for much back and forth. A review article allows a lot greater space, much greater space to develop some thoughts and arguments and have a scholarly discourse with the book. And that is slightly different than merely writing an article. Sometimes you could do that if you wanted to interact with a scholar's views just in a traditional article, but there you might, you know, not contain yourself to a single work. You might, you know, interact with several thinkers or even with one thinker, but with his or her entire corpus. And so the review article is a handy format where you may, you know, interact in greater depth, you know, with a single work. And generally, it's probably going to need to be something current, too. So if you want to get in the mix and get in the conversation on an important book, then review articles are kind of the way to do that. So Jim's review article here, Jim, I'm looking at the pages. Yours spans from 365 to 381 of, you know, that's a lot of words. I mean, that's not a book review. And it's definitely not a book report either, but it's actually a critical engagement. It's not supposed to be a book report. It's not a synopsis. It's not an abstract or a summary. It's a critical engagement. You know, there is a report in here. It tells you what the book's about, but then a critical engagement with it. So that's what we have here. A review article, again, of Darren Sumner's Karl Barth and the Incarnation.
Yeah, it just if I could say one other thing here in conjunction with this, and part of the reason why this ended up turning into a review article, you know, Van Til was one to teach us that it is very important that before you offer any type of criticism or critical interaction with somebody, if you're going to wax polemical, it's very important that what you do is you read the person, you understand them, you read them closely, you understand them, and then you engage with them charitably. And that is kind of the advice that I had in mind as I engaged this book. My engagement is going to be on the ideas that come to the surface, both as they come inspired by Barth himself, but also as they are presented by Darren Sumner as well. So I'm gonna try to engage with that spirit in mind. So I wanted to show for the reader that I am trying to engage with what Sumner actually says. And so I spend a good deal of time unpacking the content of the book and trying to faithfully reproduce the arguments that Darren is making in the book. Now, I may very well have failed to do that at points, and I am open to listeners and others who want to push back on the review and say, well, it doesn't sound like you quite got Darren correct here. But the spirit with which I am trying to engage the book is one of understanding, and then only then, once understanding has been established, to have a charitable, critical engagement with the work. So anyway, that contributed to the length of the review, wanting to make sure I get down on paper and before our readers, very clear what it is Darren is himself arguing and what it is he is actually saying, so that we're not kind of shadow boxing with a mixing metaphors here, but you know, straw man argumentation.
Yeah. I wonder if we could open up briefly before diving into some of the details of this book and the theology of Karl Barth and his doctrine of the incarnation. But the difference, the similarity and the difference between historical theology and systematic theology. Because when you're doing a work like this, no doubt there's an element here where you need to be a faithful historical theologian. But then you have to take it the next step and do systematic theology in your interaction here, both with Barth's ideas and with Sumner's ideas. In the modern day, probably in the last few decades, I'm not saying this is something new perhaps, but there is a tendency sometimes for people to think that the two disciplines are effectively the same. I mean, we should never say that they're completely unrelated or hermetically sealed. But historical theology and systematic theology, can properly speaking, they're different disciplines, aren't they, Jim?
Yeah, they are. They have their different disciplines with different methods and ways of approach. And those particular methods and ways of approach that are distinctive to the disciplines need to be respected.
So you can be a faithful historical theologian of Barth and read all of Barth's works, interact with him deeply, and come to certain conclusions that you might believe have no warrant in Scripture, possibly. As a historical theologian, you're trying to understand what Barth actually thought and how that fits in context with the development of theology and history throughout the ages. As a systematic theologian, our principia here is Scripture. We always begin with a revelation of God and develop what is a true theology. That's what the scholastics would often call a theologia vera, but that needs to be based on God's revelation. And so there's kind of a two-step process, at least as I read your article and articles like it, where you're reading a work like Sumner, which is what we call secondary literature. It's a secondary resource, not a primary source, but a secondary source. And that is, it's a book about Barth, who wrote books. So now we've got three layers in, because Jim has his reading and his opinion of Barth and of what Barth actually said. But then, Jim, you have your views on whether or not that's correct. And so you kind of have to triangulate matters a bit, don't you, when you're reading a book like this? And I've had to do that with Ronner, because you certainly study a guy and you think you have a good handle of him and you understand what he's saying. But then you read 10 different theologians and you find that everyone's kind of got different emphases or maybe a slightly different view. And you have to figure out how far off you are, or perhaps did the guy change his views over time? It can get rather complicated.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we are today. That's the game that's being played today. And if you wrote enough books and you're dead long enough, it's only a matter of time before some PhD students come along and start debating with one another about what it is that you actually wrote and thought and believed. And that's kind of where we are with Karl Barth. It's been that way for commentary on Barth has been going on since the days that he wrote his commentary on Romans. So this isn't something new, secondary literature on Barth, but it's certainly become cottage industry, maybe, of BART interpreters, where really this is the name of the game today in certain circles, is really to endlessly debate on what exactly it is that BART believed and taught and wrote. And I say endlessly, I don't mean to demean it, and I don't mean to demean it by calling it a cottage industry either, but because it's a worthy endeavor, I think. I mean, Karl Barth is the type of seminal thinker that comes along only once, every 400 or 500 years. He's just kind of that seminal in his impact and influence in the history of theology. So you have to engage him. You have to figure out what it is he said, so that to the end that the church might develop an advance a faithful theology. And it may be that BART is the type of person we go to and we resource for a constructive, positive, kingdom advancing theology. Or not. We don't need to disguise where our opinions are here at Reform Forum, because on Reform Forum we've made it very clear that Karl Barth's theology is not the type of theology that we would want to go to resource for advancing a faithful Reformed theology for today. Mm-hmm. I'm not embarrassed at all to say that. That's my opinion. That is informed by quite a few years now of reading Barth and researching on him in the secondary literature. Other people come to different conclusions. I think that if I read Darren here correctly, I think that he would see that there are significant elements of Karl Barth's theology that he would want to resource for advancing a kingdom kind of to put forward a kingdom advancing theology for today. So we have different opinions on that. That's okay. We can have those debates and discussions in the area of scholarship, and that's kind of what is happening here. We have the primary sources, Barth's writings, and then we have secondary literature like my book or like Darren's book, yours on Karl Rahner. And then here we have a book review, third layer in, and try to engage on really those questions and those facts. Is some of the issues that are being brought up helpful for the church today? And and I have my own particular view that comes out in the article on that.
Sure. Let's talk now about Barth and the Incarnation. Of course, that's one of the big topics. If there are two, I mean, maybe it's a debate, but you know, you think about Barth and you think about what some of the big ideas are, or at least the most discussed ideas. You certainly have the Incarnation, but you also, you know, have his doctrine of revelation and inspiration. And those two things are not unrelated. What's the general purview of Sumner's book? What's he addressing here? Is it all of Barth's theology of the Incarnation, or is he focusing in on something specific?
Well, it seems, I think if I'm reading him correctly, he's wanting to focus in on the Incarnation, and particularly the nature of the hypostatic union. Okay. How it is that the two natures have come together in the union of the person of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And how it is that Barth articulates that and speaks about it. What I try to do in my review is basically the review is broken down into two parts. The first part of the review is a summary of a close reading and summary of Sumner's book. And throughout that section, that first section, I kind of drop hints as to where I'm going to go in the second section. And those hints are in the forms of questions. Okay. So they're critical questions. I'll summarize what Sumner says, in that particular chapter. And then I'll ask questions like, you know, is this, you know, where Barth is going? How does this affect our understanding of the Incarnation? How does this affect the extra Calvinisticum? We'll talk about that more in a moment. And then in the second section, I take up some of those questions that I asked in the first question, first section, and I unpack what I have in view with those questions, and then I try to provide some answers critical answers, critical engagement with both Sumner's and Bart's thought. So that's kind of the way that the article is structured in a kind of a over.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's begin then. What are, you know, provide us, if you would, a sketch of the summary of the contents and his argument before we start interacting with it.
Sure, sure. So as the first section of the review article, I talk about how the book consists of five chapters. There is an introductory chapter, bibliography, so forth, and so on. Chapter one, Sumner begins with with a survey of the history of Christology. And he talks about differing views that arise within the history of Christology, particularly with a view towards asking the question, how do we understand the incarnate Christ? How do we understand the hypostatic union, the coming together of the human and divine nature in the one person of Christ? And he talks about there being an instrumentalist view. In other words, in the instrumentalist view, the eternal Son of God uses human flesh as kind of the vehicle by which he, you know, carries out his ministry here on earth. And then he argues, moving on, that there is then developing in the history of theology a compositional model. And the compositional model is much more in keeping with what, you know, we come to know through the Council of Chalcedon, where the person of Jesus Christ is two natures that have been brought together without confusion and without separation. So there are different types of compositional views that he goes through, and he highlights those very well for us, and you really do learn a good deal about the history of Christology by reading through these chapters. And then he goes on, and I think that if I could, I mean, I don't want to go through here in a micro fashion, Camden, because
just read your article.
otherwise I'm just reading my article. Yeah. But let me, if I could, just kind of jump to the nuts and bolts of it. And if I could, this is the way that I would summarize the argument after that first chapter. Sumner seems to be very, very concerned about an abiding instrumentalism within Christology throughout the ages. So he sees that, for example, in what we would call the extra Calvinisticum. Okay, the extra Calvinisticum in very short terms, and we can't unpack it here with the kind of precision that perhaps is warranted, but in a nutshell, the extra Calvinisticum basically teaches us that the divine nature of Christ is not, when it is united to the human nature in the incarnation, it does not in any way lose any of its divineness. It doesn't. It is not so constricted by the humanity of Christ that somehow, for instance, when Christ dies, the human nature dies as well. Right? It's a way of protecting the divine nature from somehow being affected by what happens in the human life of Christ. All right. Now, for Sumner, it seems like he is quite concerned about the extra Calvinisticum, and it's well known that Bart himself was concerned about the extra Calvinisticum and downright rejected it. Okay. And Darren, at a number of points, expresses a concern about there being an incarnation, an indwelling of the human nature with in the extra Calvinisticum with some divine substance somehow remaining, there being a divine remainder that kind of does not get incarnate, Okay. So he'll, what he ends up doing, and I think he does it actually very well, is he describes the debates that were going on in the 16th century between the Lutheran and the Calvinian perspective on Christology, which, of course, as you know, affected the way in which the debates played out with regard to the Lord's Supper, right? So that what you have in the Lutheran view, particularly with a form of kenosis, right, this idea that somehow, some way, divine properties get communicated to the human nature in Lutheran kenosis, that ends up playing a part of the criticism that people were making against Calvin and the Reformed view of Christology. And so the extra, what we know as the extra Calvinisticum, was sort of a polemical expression that the Lutherans used against the Reformed.
Yeah, it was derogatory.
It was derogatory, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, you know.
Well, Calvinist hears it and says, well, that sounds like common sense. But it was originally a derogatory term, as far as I understood, that Lutherans made toward Calvinists.
That's right. And so the Lutherans believed or argued that the Reformed kind of had a dual logos, right? There was a logos who was in sarkos, right, in the flesh. And then there was also a logos or a part of a logos that was asarkos, right, outside of the flesh. Mm-hmm. And that there was a kind of, you know, as the incarnation happens, what it does is the human nature squeezes out or leaves out or excludes something of the logos, such that there is a part of the logos which is not incarnate, or even worse, as the Lutherans argued against the Reformed in some context, that there were two logoses, one that was in the flesh, and then there was another one still in
it's
heaven
kind of
somewhere.
Alternate form of Nestorianism is what's being charged.
That's exactly correct. And so it's that kind of supposed abiding Nestorianism that is Sumner's concern as he's, you know, channeling here. I don't mean to use that in a disrespectful or derogatory way, but channeling here Bart. That's the core and the heart of the contention of the book as a whole. Now, in the second section, where I start to ask some critical questions, I'm going to kind of, what I do there is I kind of poke at some of the assumptions that go into Darren's contention, okay? And some of those assumptions are ontological in nature, okay? No pun intended.
Yeah.
No redundancy intended, anyway. Mm-hmm. But are ontological in nature, so that what Sumner is one of the things that comes up time and again that I kind of call into question is that what Bart is doing when he rejects the extra Calvinisticum is he is trying to understand Christology on the terms that have been set by modernity. Okay, that's kind of an expression that comes up again. What does he mean by that? What he means by that is a modern approach to metaphysics or a modern ontology that would be post-Kantian. And if we could break it down even more than that, Camden, that is in fact anti-Hellenistic, or that is maybe more, if we want to get more specific, anti-Aristotelian, anti-Scholastic. Okay, approach to ontology, which says that there are that things or substances or substances are in fact things, something that can be grasped and held on to, as opposed to, let's say, Bart's view of ontology, which is actualistic, right? Or to use the older term that Van Til uses, activistic, which is trying to understand the nature of God and other things, but particularly the nature of God, not in terms of what God is, not in terms of static realities, okay, but more dynamically, not abstract, like abstract substances or abstract views of nature, but concrete, dynamic and actual categories. So in other words, we define who God is, not according to some abstract nature, but according to what it is he does, what his acts are. Okay. And so Darren wants to, as far as I'm reading him, it seems, is wanting to say, what does Bart teach us about advancing Christology today that that adheres to or that accedes to the terms that have been set by this modern view of ontology? That, in other words, there can't be substances. We can't have an essentialist ontology whatsoever. And we would all agree that there are problems and there are liabilities with Aristotle and with the Hellenistic view of metaphysics and with scholastic ontology and Thomas particularly. I mean, we have not been shy about that on this show, certainly, or on this website.
Ad nauseum for some people, I'm sure.
Yeah, ad nauseum for some people, for sure. So we would certainly recognize that there are liabilities there. At the same time, I'm not yet ready to concede that modernity has proven its case. That when we speak about ontology or we speak about the being of God or of God's essence, who he is, that we must give up essentialist categories. I'm not ready to concede that yet. And so what I want to do, part of my argumentation, is to say, is it in fact maybe premature for us to go, and this comes out in the second half of the review article, is it perhaps immature for us to move too quickly away from or beyond Chalcedon, and then the way in which Chalcedon was appropriated by the Reformed in the 16th century? Particularly, I have a view towards the Extra Calvinisticum, which, just to tip my hand, if it hasn't been tipped already, is something that I'm particularly favorable towards. And so I'm not ready to yet kind of accede to that argumentation that modernity and post-Kantian metaphysics or approach to ontology is necessarily what we need to somehow now reconstruct or reorient our Christology around or accede to their particular terms. And that's Camden, kind of the nutshell argument of the second half of the article.
Well, that being said, that's an engagement, or at least that's an activity or a project in summarizing what Sumner has said. You haven't offered judgment heretofore, but where do you think Sumner is strong here? Where do you agree with him on those points?
I agree with Sumner. In so many ways, more ways than I don't. So I'll put it to you that way. I think that, I try to make this very clear in the review article, that Sumner really does get Bart. At least, you know, I'm using a standard here for getting Bart, right? I agree with Sumner's interpretation. Generally speaking, of Bart's approach to theology. I don't think we have a whole lot of disagreements there. I think he is a very close and careful interpreter of Karl Barth. I think that his interpretation of Bart is not all that much different than what you would find, for instance, in the work that I've done on Bart, my dissertation, and then published as God's Time for Us. I think that there's going to be a lot of overlap and a lot of agreement in terms of how we understand Bart. So I think that Sumner gets Bart. And having done his dissertation at Princeton, he's studied under the best in terms of English speaking interpreters of Karl Barth. He's been obviously trained well, and you can see that throughout his writing. And I think that what's interesting, if I could make a side point here, sure. this really is a side point because this is bringing in Vant Hill. And I don't want to belabor this. This is not where I intend to bring our interview, ultimately, but I think it's worth our saying this. I'm amazed the more and more that I read secondary literature, and we were talking about what secondary literature is at the beginning of this program, but the more and more that I read the secondary literature on Barthes, the more and more impressed I am with the fact that as scholarship on Barthes' thought develops and grows and advances, and I think in many ways gets more and more clear and precise, I'm more and more persuaded that Vant Hill, at the essence of his read of Karl Barthes, understood and got Karl Barthes as well. And I think that we need to, if I could just belabor this point a little bit longer, I think that we need to kind of make a distinction between Vant Hill's understanding of Barthes and Vant Hill's thesis of Karl Barthes.
Yeah, that's okay? A good point. So, that goes back to the earlier point about historical theology and systematic theology. It's related there.
That's exactly correct. And I think that, I don't think that there's any dispute. If you were to take some of the best of the interpreters of Karl Barthes today and sit them down and then, pull the points that Vant Hill was making about how he understood Barthes' theology and put him on the table, I don't think that there would be much disagreement actually at all about how Vant Hill understood Karl Barthes. The point of contention really comes about Vant Hill's thesis about Karl Barthes, which is that Barthianism and Christianity are not two competing forms of the same religion, but are two mutually opposed religions altogether. That's a very strong thesis, obviously, and a very polemical one.
Oh, yeah.
But I think and that's controversial, and I get that, and we could debate that issue. But I think that, and the more and more I read Barthes, the more and more I read Vant Hill, and more that I read scholars like Darren Sumner, the more and more I am persuaded that Vant Hill understood Karl Barthes' theology correctly. And so as I read Sumner, I agree with Sumner's understanding of Barthes because I'm reading Karl Barthes as unabashedly, unapologetically a Vantillian. And I read Sumner and I go, wow, I mean, Vant Hill and Sumner could sit down and talk about understanding Karl Barthes all day long, and I don't think there would be much of a disagreement at all between them. Now, the disagreement will happen when Vant Hill puts his thesis down, but in terms of understanding, I think that there would be a lot of overlap. Probably, vast majority of the things that they cover would be agreed upon wholeheartedly.
Well, so, but insofar as I've read a little bit of Karl Barthes, not a ton. I would agree with you there. I had a class on it. I'm looking at a shelf. I got two shelves worth of Barthes stuff. that statement that you just make how many people would agree with that? That Vant Hill assessed him correctly, or is it just too hard for critics to split his thesis from the assessment? But in my experience, you'd find that I would imagine there are quite a few people that would contend your view. That they would challenge it.
No doubt. And I think that if we were to be fair, I think that if you are interpreting, I was hoping, you pushed me here because now I got to say this, and I was hoping to just kind of avoid saying it. But I think that if you're sitting at a table, okay, with a George Hunziker, Paul Molnar, okay. These interpreters of Karl Barthes, who tend to, in my view, tend to interpret Karl Barthes as being much more in keeping with Orthodox Reformed theology. Okay, and if you were to sit down with them, yes, I do believe that they would contend that statement very much so. But if you are sitting down with, you know, with a, let's say a Bruce McCormick or Darren Sumner and kind of the McCormick school of interpretation, I think that the disagreements would be far less than what it would be as you sit down with the George Hunziker Mulder group. Okay.
But then you have McCormick who's written a book, Orthodox and Modern, correct? So he would interpret Bart in the more progressive side of things, not trying to shoehorn him into an Orthodox theology, but then he'll also go and argue that that progressive interpretation is Orthodox.
Yeah, and that's, by the way, just getting back, Darren makes a very similar argument in his book as well. And what Darren is wanting to say is that, and I'm glad you brought this up because this is important to say, especially as we're talking the way we are now. Darren wants to say that what Bart does is he stays faithful to the basic contours of Chalcedonian Christology, but reformulates it in such a way that it is in keeping with modern ontology or modernity.
Yeah, this is just like Rahner. I mean, this is where you see these theological geniuses doing this work. What's interesting for me is why Bart would be motivated to do this. I mean, that's a historical question. I was just having a conversation with Ryan Noah, you know, our friend, and he, I was talking to him a bit about the historical developments that seem to parallel one another between Catholicism and Presbyterianism, not American Presbyterianism specifically, and then Catholicism more broadly, because you have the battle with the modernist fundamentalists occurring in the early 20th century for the Catholics that resulted in a anti-modernist oath, which forbade any of the Catholic clergy from being an expressed or avowed modernist. They had to reject it. How many of them actually rejected it ex animo, I don't know. But they had to, on the surface, at least verbally, reject modernism. But years before, in 1879, I believe it was, with Attorney Patris, the Pope basically gave the thumbs up and approval, the official, you know, approval seal to Thomas Aquinas's philosophy to be the official philosophy of the Roman Catholic Church. And when you do that, if you want to be a Catholic, you want to be, united to the Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and you want to be a theologian, though, who engages in modern theology and modern philosophy and wants to feel free to go where your studies take you, that presents a problem. Because now you're bound to Thomistic philosophy and you're anti-modernist. And that, for me, is when I look at theologians like Karl Rahner, my conviction and understanding is that that motivates them to a new form of creativity, where you use certain philosophies, you know, whether it's a Kantian paradigm or something similar, to subvert and circumvent the other theologies and philosophies without entirely supplanting them or removing them. And so you can end up with Rahner being called, this perhaps isn't the best label, but he's frequently called a transcendental Thomist. In my assessment, is really no true Thomist at all. But he can still say he's a Thomist, but he's used Kant to come up with something entirely different from Thomas's philosophy.
Yeah.
But it keeps him within the bounds of, you know, church order,
right,
to remain a Thomist, even though he's basically, you know, circumvented it entirely.
Well, that's what Van Til has been saying, you know, all along from the very beginning, is that much of Bart's writing maintains a lot of the kind of external form of orthodoxy, right? So, you know, they don't use the expression anymore today, but they used to call it neo-orthodoxy. Bart's thought and those who were in his circles, and liberals had a distaste for it because they thought it sounded an awful lot like the old orthodoxy, right? But we're starting to figure out now, and this is the genius of Bruce McCormick and you know, the volume of collection of essays he put together, Orthodox and Modern, is to show this very fact that the form Of the older theology, this is not McCormick's language, this is my summary, but the form of the older orthodoxy is retained, but really it's been filled in with modern content because it's starting from, it presupposes and it advances a modern view of metaphysics, which is an anti-metaphysical approach to ontology. And so it can't, in substance, again, I don't mean to, you know, play on that word substance, but sure. But in substance or at its heart, at its core, it can't be, and it can't be the old orthodoxy. And that's the question. That's another question that comes up in my article. He asked me where I agree with Sumner, where I disagree. I mean, I agree with Sumner on his understanding of Barth. I think that I'm not sure that see, Sumner, as the way I read him, he grants the Lutheran critique of the Reformed. And I disagree there in the in my article. I'm pretty sure, in fact, that the Lutherans did not get the Reformed right on Christology, yeah. on the hypostatic union and the extra Calvinisticum. So so I call that into question. I would disagree with him there. I would disagree with his granting the Lutheran critique of the Reformed. Okay. But in terms of his when he is unpacking Barth's thought, it's beautiful. I mean, and I agree with him most of the way. I mean, I probably, I don't know, you know, 80-90% of the time I'm not in my head. I'm like, yeah, this is spot on. This is spot on. This is exactly right. That's what I would say, you know? And so I do think though, that the rub really is on this very issue. Is it in fact the case, number one, that the Lutherans got the Reformed extra Calvinisticum correct? Number two, is the Lutheran or is Sumner's or Barth's solution or alternative to the extra Calvinisticum, is it faithful to Chalcedonian Christology? And I think the answer has to be no. I don't know. And I don't know how you can adopt an anti orthodox view of ontology and still maintain in any meaningful sense Chalcedonian Christology or Reformed Christology, because I see the Reformed as standing well within the Chalcedonian tradition. And in fact, who was it? I think it was Carl Truman in his John Owen book, you know, calls the extra Calvinisticum the extra Catholicum, right? You know, it's a Catholic, it's a universal doctrine that is not restricted to the Reformed or to Calvin himself, but actually, you know, is part and parcel of the Orthodox tradition going back to Chalcedon. So anyway, I just don't see how you can have Barth's alternative to the extra Calvinisticum and say that it is still orthodox. I just don't see those two as being compatible.
Yeah. Well, we'll certainly have to interact further and see if people can offer some insight, maybe challenge some of our views or theses and see if we can move forward, whether that be from other Barthian interpreters or from various Lutherans who may be listening, whatever it may be, there's plenty of opportunity for further conversation. And of course, you can read the entire review article. There's a lot more there in the Westminster Theological Journal, Volume 79, Number 2. That's Fall 2017. You can find it on, let me get the page open. You can find it on page 365 all the way through 381. Jim's article, A Review of Karl Barth and the Incarnation by Darren O. Sumner. Thanks so much, Jim, for contributing here. I do want to thank our listeners also for paying attention and following along. Visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you can find information about all of our programs. You can comment in the comment field and the comment thread on this episode. And get in touch with us. You can also send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us @reformedforum. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you join us again next time. on Christ the Center.